Presenting on behalf of another colleague of mine, Jeff Conant. My name is Sarah Shannon, and I am with the Hesperian Foundation, which is an organization that you will learn more about from a co-worker, Darlena David, who's going to follow. But very briefly, we believe in making health information as accessible as possible so that it helps people both act practically to deal with their own health problems, but also to organize about them. And because there's an ongoing pun in this whole presentation about it, our best-known book is Where There's No Doctor. So today I want to briefly give you an overview about people's health movement and then look at the global water crisis. We'll look a little bit at the dimensions of who's using the world's water and for what purposes. And then because this is shockingly, we've discovered that corporations are not the best water stewards in the world. So we'll look a little bit at that issue, and then building off of that, people's health movement's health justice agenda for water, for better water stewardship, and finally some signs of hope and how you can get involved. People's health movement's roots go back to 1978 and before that. Some of us in this room have enough gray hairs to indicate that we do remember Health for All by the year 2000, which was declared in 1978 as part of the Alma Ata. So we certainly also experienced what happened in the ensuing years between 78 and 2000, where Health for All most certainly was not achieved. You can see from this diagram a few of the things that were experienced instead. So in December 2000, over 1,500 delegates, community health workers, health activists from 60 countries came together in the First People's Health Assembly in Bangladesh to generate a call to action, which is the People's Charter for Health. And there's actually copies in the back if you're interested in it. It looks like the copy we have here looks like this. A few of the fundamental points from this document, and it's really worth reading. Health is a social, economic, and political issue, and above all, a fundamental human right. Health for all means that powerful interests have to be challenged, that globalization has to be opposed, and that political and economic priorities have to be drastically changed. And equity and ecologically sustainable development and peace are at the heart of our vision for a better world. And there are more than enough resources to achieve this vision. So people's health movement really does start from the framework of promoting a comprehensive right to health. And that means promoting ongoing activism, both to organize for quality health care that's accessible for all, but also, and at the same time, in a very linked way, organizing for equity and access to the determinants of health, such as water, food, food security, nutrition, housing, etc. So today I want to look specifically at the right to health, right to water, that is certainly a part of the right to health platform of people's health movement. So first, let's look briefly at the water crisis. Now, as involved, responsible global citizens, you're no doubt aware. Oh, and by the way, APHA today just decided that the 2009 meeting's theme will be water and public health. So I guess the APHA is aware of this, too. So we can look forward to that and maybe think about that as we go through these statistics a little bit. So we're no doubt aware about the dimensions of the global crisis. Water scarcity, what happened? Ah, there it is. Such tricky things. And the impact that this has on people's health. What is maybe less, getting much less attention, certainly in the mainstream media, though, is how that water is being used, and the underlying inequity about the way that scarce water resources are distributed and used. So this gives us a little bit of an overview. 12% of the world's population uses 85% of the world's water. Actually sounds kind of familiar. It's like similar resource distribution to many other things. Consider the way water is used, even between the U.S. and Europe, which is usually one of the larger resource users, too. According to WHO, each person needs 13 gallons of water a day for drinking, cooking, bathing, and basic sanitation. In the U.S., we're using an average of 65 to 78 gallons of water per day per person for those very same uses, although I think that also includes watering our lawns. In the Netherlands, for those very same purposes, people only use 27 gallons a day, and in the Gambia, where we can assume they're not watering lawns, they're using 1.17 gallons per day, which is obviously way below what is the minimum needs. So one of the things that is puzzling or not getting addressed, perhaps, is why it is that global water consumption is doubling so much faster than population. And this may give us a little bit of a sense of, well, where is that water being used? And I was at least surprised the first time I saw this statistic, because you generally hear about individual water consumption. But in fact, agriculture is the primary user of human uses of water, with 65% simply going to irrigation. Industry total uses 25%, and municipalities and individual uses is 10%. Okay, so one of the really main components of a health justice perspective on the right to water, a rights-based perspective, is recognizing, first of all, that water is a basic public good and that we need to prioritize people's needs over profits. Now, to be able to really understand the importance of that perspective, I think we do need to look a little bit at what is happening with the corporate-driven agenda and why that has not led to good water stewardship. And perhaps the folks in this room aren't going to be terribly shocked to learn about this, but we should look at and familiarize ourselves with this a little bit more. So there's two major ways in which the corporate agenda shapes water use. And one is the privatization of municipal water systems, which has certainly led to increased inequities in access and also not improved delivery or quality of water. The other one is how profit has been driving the way that water is used in industry and agriculture. So we're going to look at that in more detail. Let's look first at commercialization of water in terms of water delivery systems. This is a pretty interesting set of statistics here. There's 10 major corporate players really working in water these days, but of those 10, three already deliver almost 300 million deliver water services to 300 million customers in 100 countries. And at their current rate of expansion, those three alone are going to control 70% of the water systems in Europe and North America in one decade. And the World Bank, of course, is a big player in this. They have required conversion of public systems to private systems worldwide, particularly in the last 5 years. So we often hear that privatization is actually the solution to the water problem, not the problem itself. So let's look at that a little bit more, because in fact, this is privatizing water should make people conserve it, right, if they have to pay for it. So let's look at what really happens. Pretty much across the board, at a minimum, when water systems are privatized, rates go up by two-thirds. Two good examples of this are Bolivia and South Africa, and both places upon privatization, almost immediately rates tripled. And that, of course, led to a number of people losing access to water. Now, it isn't just happening in developing countries. Let's look at what happened in the UK. In England, when water was privatized in 1985, there was a 106% price hike, while profits, of course, increased by almost 700%. And there's been a 50% increase in customers losing their water, having their water cut off in England as a basis of that privatization. So we don't have to go very far to see that, nor do we have to go very far to see the impact of privatization on poor water quality and poor delivery of service. We only have to go as far as Atlanta or some other places in the United States, in fact. But here's a good one in Atlanta. Suez took over the water system some years back. A lot of you may already know about this. But as soon as that water system was taken over, they began having serious problems with the quality of the water. There were 5 boil water alerts in a single year where the water was so contaminated that it was unsafe to drink. The water was increasingly brown due to rust and debris. Less than half of the basic scheduled repairs were completed in 1 year, and fire hydrants lacked sufficient water pressure to function. Okay, that's just, now imagine Atlanta where there, of course it is the home of the CDC too, but where there's regulations supposedly in place to ensure this that supposedly function. Imagine this in some other places where there's a little bit less regulatory strength. And of course, imagine the world where there is no water system. Commercialization still, however, affects us or affects those where there is no water system. A good example being, and one that actually I want to share with you because it was pretty fun, a Canadian company, Global Water Corporation, signed an agreement with Sitka, Alaska to export 18 billion gallons per year of glacier water to China, where it is to be bottled in one of the free trade zones to save on labor costs. So if that isn't a good example of globalization at its best, I don't know what is. Okay, agriculture, which is actually where most of the world's water is used. Irrigation is 65% of all water used by humans, and yet 60% of that is wasted through evaporation, runoff, and leakage. So there's a number of ways that irrigation could be done much more effectively. Why not? Why isn't it being done? Because it's too expensive. And yet if drip irrigation or flood irrigation were used instead, we'd save enough to satisfy the water needs of 3.6 million people per year. And again, where there is no irrigation happens to be Africa. 5% of the world's irrigation water is used in Africa. So we can see that irrigation and crop production is not happening in Africa. We can imagine where it is happening. And again, why is it that that more efficient uses of water in agriculture are not being implemented? If we look at it, if we were to try and do some conservation in agriculture, ecologically appropriate crops would be the most efficient way to do it, of course. And intensive organic agriculture is actually one of the best ways to conserve water. And it produces higher yield than extensive industrial agriculture. And yet, that's not what our food systems are based on, and I think we can also know why. So let's look really quickly at industrial uses. This was also surprising to me. When I imagined industrial uses of water, I was thinking about manufacturing. In fact, manufacturing of everything in the world comes third. The biggest uses in industrial use of water are mining and oil extraction. Now, coincidentally or not, perhaps, those also happen to be the two industries that do the most damage to our water resources through destruction of watersheds as well as contamination. So that was a kind of a sobering realization and also one to think about if we want to try and take steps at reducing water use or using putting people over profits in terms of water use. Let's look very briefly at what the core principles of a rights-based approach then for water stewardship are, since we're, I think, fairly convinced that the corporate-driven agenda doesn't lead to good water stewardship. So human right to water is clearly important, and that is necessary in order to recognize water as a public good. We also need democratic control of our water resources to help us deal with how to find the best balance between all the different competing needs for water. Clean production in industry to make sure that we are using the water as well as we can. Equitable distribution to ensure basic needs are met, and we can invest in healthy and sustainable conservation. The human right for water is a growing movement that is necessary in order to really acknowledge internationally and nationally right to water. This is some of the places that you can go to where this is really active and where I could suggest as resources. In terms of democratic control over water resources, again, these are some of the most important points. And that this process needs to be as participatory as possible. Clean production, for those of you who aren't familiar with the term, means that water can be recycled and reused in industry in a way that minimizes the toxics as well as minimizes the use of water. It's completely possible, but it does have a financial cost, which is why industry tends to resist it. That cost is small compared to the long-term effects or long-term benefits. And here's a few examples of ways we can accomplish better water stewardship. Briefly, I'm going to skim right through some signs of hope here. Right to water is getting established in a number of different countries' constitutions, notably Uruguay. And there's a lot of efforts to reclaim control over water systems. We're probably all familiar with Bolivia's victories, also in Atlanta, where Suez has been kicked out, Argentina as well. And the global water struggle is becoming global. One of the most exciting things is a national front uniting water struggle, in multinational front uniting water struggles. Red Vita in Latin America has joined with Pan-African Water Movement and Friends of the Right to Water working in Europe and North America and Asia. So there really is, at this point, an emerging global water movement. We urge you to join the People's Health Movement's Right to Health campaign as another way to support the right to water. And here are some resources. Sorry for the advertisement, but I do recommend these. Damnation, which gives a great overview of ways you can conserve water here, Water for Life, which is a Hesperian publication, and Sanitation and Cleanliness for Healthy Environment. Both of those latter are parts of our upcoming and soon-to-be-released book on community environmental health, and here's some information. Come visit us at our booth at 303 after this session.
Thank you very much.